The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. So here's a question that's been puzzling me for at least 4 years, and it's about God. Not literally about God, don't worry, but about those Americans who would consider themselves among God's most ardent followers. I'm talking about white evangelical Christians. In 2016, they were all in for Donald Trump. No voting bloc was more committed to him than them. In that year, he got 81% of the white evangelical vote, and they stood by him again in 2020. Last month, his support among that group was 75%, down a bit, but still huge. And yet look at the man they're backing, a thrice married vulgarian, as one writer put it, a man who clearly worships mammon and himself above all else, a man who could not cite a single Bible verse when he was asked to, a man who has been accused of cheating on his third wife with a porn performer while that wife was at home tending to their newborn son. In two words, how come? How did America's strictest Christians, the family values crowd, come to throw in their lot with Donald Trump? And now that Trump is, slowly, on his way out, where does that leave his Christian backers? Will they regret it, or will they stay with him all the way to 2024? With me to pick our way through that thicket is Lerone Martin, who's Associate Professor of Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Or should that be St. Louis? I suppose that's my first question to you, Lerone Martin. Which is it?
Here we say St. Louis, but I could certainly see my MapQuest and all my digital map guides always say St. Louis.
Now, that distinction I began with right at the top, Lerone, when I talked about white evangelicals singling that group out. I mean, am I on solid ground doing that? Would I be right to say that among black Christians, the picture is very different?
That is correct. That is correct. African-American Protestants share a great deal in common with their white evangelical brothers and sisters as it relates to theological commitments around the ideas of the Bible, the significance of Jesus Christ, the importance of individual salvation, but they arrive at very different political conclusions.
I know this, Lerone, is very much your specialist area. You've written a huge amount on this. Given that there is a convergence between black and white evangelicals on matters of religion, what accounts for the divergence on matters of politics?
One of the major issues is race and how African-American Christians and white evangelicals understand race and racism in America. All the studies that we've seen show us that white evangelicals really understand racism as something that resides in individual hearts and therefore can be rooted out and removed by conversion to Christianity in particular, but more specifically, conversion to evangelical Christianity. Whereas many African-American Christians, because of the experience of Black Americans, understand racism as something that is really baked into American society and institutions. So what I like to say is simply that most white evangelical Christians understand racism that resides in individual souls, whereas many African-American Christians understand racism as something that resides in the soul of the nation.
Oh, that's a good distinction. I get that. And so words like systemic and institutional racism might be used by black evangelicals, but that is not a language white evangelicals would naturally or even theologically feel comfortable with.
Correct. There is a small remnant that is moving in that direction, seeking to engage in reconciliation. But the overwhelming majority of white evangelical Christians understand, especially those who are supportive of Donald Trump, would say racism is something that is just in individual souls. And for example, you can see Donald Trump, for example, or William Barr, who was the Attorney General, head of our Justice Department here in the United States, both would say there is no such thing as systemic racism within American police departments, despite the countless studies we've seen to the contrary.
So you agree that there may be systemic racism?
To the extent, in where?
Let me continue my line of questioning.
I don't agree that there's systemic racism in the police department.
Specifically.
Generally in this country.
And there was that congressional hearing, I think, where Barr was really reluctant to let the phrase sort of pass his lips. He wouldn't accede to that definition. Just before we leave this very specific point, I mean, there were some African-American clergy who did side with Donald Trump. I mean, not many, not big numbers, but enough to be sort of photographed and talked about. For them to make that move, would they have to sign up then for the kind of individual souls analysis? Is that handful of black pastors who endorsed Trump, would that be their theological position when it came to racism?
Correct. Most would side with that. And this is a long tradition here of having a number of African-American religious broadcasters in particular who will side with white evangelicals or white conservative Protestants. One of the most outstanding examples of this in history is a gentleman by the name of Lightfoot Solomon Mashaw.
When we enter into the kingdom, the present sufferings of this world will not be worthy to be compared.
He partnered with the FBI in the 1950s and 60s to help launder information from the FBI to help to discredit Martin Luther King. So there's a long tradition of African-American religious broadcasters who are primarily focused on evangelism, primarily focused on the salvation of individual souls, who see within their white evangelical brothers and sisters allies in the cause of bringing America back to God.
So let's. I realize we should have done this probably even earlier on, but now's as good a time as any. Let's define our terms. What do you understand by the word evangelical?
I understand the term evangelical in the sense of a movement that emerged in post-war America, beginning in 1945, especially, of a group of white Protestants who came together, who believed that Protestant Christianity in America had been overtaken by liberals. So they wanted to bring a group of Christians together who believed in certain theological and political commitments. Primarily as it relates to theology, they were interested in seeing the Bible as the word of God that should be understood as divinely inspired and not as a historical document. They believed in a life of piety or holiness, and they also believed that Jesus would come back to earth in bodily form to bring about the kingdom of God. And that's on the theological side. And you can see how that is theological commitments that many African-American Christians listening to this could agree with. Now, on the political side, it was staunchly anti-communist, staunchly against big government in the form of economics. And it was committed to laissez-faire capitalism and committed to certain types of conservative Christian morals. And they believed, politically speaking, that those Christian morals needed to sit at the very center of American civic life. And the further America veered from those political commitments and moral commitments, that America was in danger of not just losing God's favor, but actually of being destroyed from within.
It's fascinating the sort of shift that it happens on both tracks. I mean, with politics and religion, which one's the tail and which one's the dog? Who's leading who here? I mean, is this a movement of Republicans getting more, you know, right-wing in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with, you know, the Reagan Revolution? Or is the Republican Party just following what's happening in the pews and in the churches as Christians, white Christians, are getting more, you know, conservative theologically and therefore politically? So who's leading who here?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think on the religious side, white evangelicals will believe that right belief or the idea that you are holding the right theological commitments will lead to certain types of political conclusions. And so they would see their religion and politics as something that is co-constitutive and related to one another. The right religious beliefs leads to the right political stances. And I think on the Republican side, some of this is simply the belief growing up in conservative America, seeing what they would argue, someone like Ronald Reagan, who becomes the governor of California in the 60s, seeing an America that he believes that was once wonderful in decline.
Just as there are some very vociferous critics from the other extreme of extreme liberalism who will take nothing less than government becoming the great nursemaid for all the people.
And he begins to drift further to the right, although he grows up with a family that is nurtured by New Deal politics and New Deal aid, and then begins his whole political campaign, of course, when he runs in California, conservative ideas, and especially when he runs for president. You see Reagan speaking of making America great again in the 80s. And so I think from the Republican side, some of it is a pragmatic choice, but some of it I think is a genuine move towards the right. And so I think you have this perfect marriage between conservative Protestants who see a liberal establishment taking over and those on the right who see a liberal establishment taking over, and they join together in this perfect marriage of conservative Protestantism and conservative politics.
Our country needs a truly great leader, and we need a truly great leader now.
What is it, in your view, that was then driving white Christians, white evangelical Christians to Donald Trump?
Overwhelmingly, I would say it was a form of white backlash. There was a great deal of concern about President Obama as it relates to being the first non-white president in this country. And we saw from the Department of Homeland Security an increase in the numbers of white supremacist groups and white supremacist activity during President Obama's administration, and also some of the moral issues as it relates to same-sex marriage. So I think part of what was driving that was a white backlash. And Donald Trump, of course, rode that wave as it relates to questioning President Obama's legitimacy about not being from here. He's not like us. He is a foreigner, or he is a Muslim in disguise.
President Obama, he is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS.
Okay? And I think that the white backlash against President Obama played a great role, as well as concerns about certain types of moral commitments as relates to marriage.
To what extent was it also just a pragmatic bargain? And this used to sort of pick up all the time. I remember talking to really people of faith who were pretty appalled, even maybe disgusted by Donald Trump back in the 2016 campaign. They, you know, talked about his infidelity and his crudeness and his rudeness to people. They didn't like it, but nevertheless said they were going to swallow their misgivings about him because of what he would do if president in terms of appointing judges to the Supreme Court and lower level federal courts. And that therefore it was a kind of, I don't want to say Faustian bargain, but it was a pragmatic bargain they were making, that they would tolerate this man simply because he was the Republican and they didn't want Hillary Clinton appointing those judges. Did you get that sense, or do you get that sense, that initially at first, and it would be very interesting to hear what then came of that feeling, but initially at first, there was this sort of slight distaste, you know, almost sort of hold your nose and vote for this man?
I did hear that thesis, if you will, that this was a pragmatic bargain. I like to disagree with that in the sense of what I see here, at the very least, is a history of pragmatism within white evangelical politics. And by that, I simply mean that there is a long history and tradition of white evangelicals siding with power over and against marginalized groups. So, for example, even as the white evangelical movement was emerging in post-war America, white evangelical institutions purposely partnered with J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI, despite Hoover not holding the same theological commitments as the as white evangelicals, questions about J. Edgar Hoover's sexuality, and of course the rumors, which we of course know to be true, that he was spying on all types of Americans and violating the Constitution. But yet still, white evangelicals partnered with the FBI. They had J. Edgar Hoover writing in Christianity Today repeatedly. He was a repeated contributor to the Journal. And of course, we see something similar with Ronald Reagan in the 60s. Ronald Reagan, we know, was not much of a churchgoer. Like Donald Trump, he was an actor. His wife was consulting an astrologer for major decisions, not Jesus, an astrologer. And yet still,
and she was his second wife. I mean, he'd been divorced.
There you go. She was exactly. She was his second wife, but yet they still decided to support him. So I like to push back on scholars and churchgoers who say, well, this was a pragmatic decision. I say that this is a long tradition within white evangelical politics. This is not something that's new. Is this really something that's just pragmatic, or is this something that is actually baked into white evangelical faith in politics?
On this business about the man himself and what they make of him, I detected a change, and I'd like to hear your sort of expert view of this, that initially, you know, before he was elected, evangelical Christians would be quite forthcoming in admitting his defects and drawbacks. They would say, look, he's not personally a holy man, but, you know, he's doing good things. And then that seemed to shift and became this, you saw it often on the right, this notion that he was now an instrument of God. And there was that meme that we saw often with Donald Trump sitting at the desk signing a bill with like a sort of ghostly Jesus figure behind him, literally physically guiding his hand. And you heard other Christians talking about, and you'll correct me on the history slash theology of this, but, you know, the Persian king Cyrus, who was deeply flawed morally himself, but through him, you know, God did great things. By the end of it, the sort of initial misgivings and disapproval had sort of melted away. And now Trump was depicted as this almost holy figure. Describe for us the journey, if you like, the evangelicals made, and if it does fit some of what I was sketching out there.
I think we see a journey from an individual who we go from is a converted, pious man to simply God's instrument. And from a converted, pious Christian to simply more of a messianic king-like figure, or a monarch, if you will. So we begin with Donald Trump and Paula White.
We ask that you would bestow upon our president the wisdom necessary to lead this great nation, the grace to unify us, and the strength to stand for what is honorable and right in your sight.
Remind us who Paula White is.
Paula White is a white evangelical preacher who is now ahead of Trump's Faith-Based Initiative Office, or Faith and Community Partnerships Office. And Paula White had told us all that she had met with Trump and he had given his life to Jesus. He was raised in church at the Marble Collegiate Church there in New York City with Norman Vincent Peale, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking. So we begin the journey by, you know, selling Trump to America as converted Christian, as she would say, a babe in Christ who's just learning about his faith.
And so this is the notion of a kind of flawed man originally, but he's come to Jesus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we can forgive his life before this. He's admitted the error of his way. And now we see that he's given his life to Jesus. As the revelations begin to unfold, both when Trump says, I don't really ask for forgiveness, as you stated in our intro, doesn't really know anything about the Bible. He cites 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. And then the revelations, the Hollywood Access tape, the revelations about Stormy Daniels, so forth and so on, almost becomes indefensible that this is an individual who has given his life to Jesus and is making concerted efforts to cultivate a certain kind of piety. So then evangelicals then begin to try to read Trump through certain types of biblical narratives and stories. The one that emerged was the King Cyrus story. The King Cyrus, of course, was, as you stated earlier, not in covenant with God, but God used King Cyrus to allow the children of Israel to return back to the promised land and rebuild the promised land. And that becomes the overarching narrative, so that evangelicals stop trying to excuse Trump's behavior and then just start simply saying, well, he's flawed, but God is still using him. And I think what we see here is this commitment to this idea that white evangelicals and the white evangelical faith belongs at the center of American polity and civic life, And now they see that somehow God is using Trump to return white evangelicals and their faith to the center of America. So this whole idea that they are in exile, no longer in control, being pushed to the side, that Trump is then God's choice, if you will, to bring them back to the center.
It came to a head a little bit in the summer of this year, where there was that, you know, famous, some would say notorious, photo op that Donald Trump did, where he was pictured holding the Bible outside St. John's Church in Washington, D.C. The crowds had been dispersed using tear gas so he could have this photograph. And a few commentators stepped forward and said, look, there's more to this image than you realize. In parts of the evangelical right, this kind of macho figure of him striding to the church surrounded by, you know, military personnel and holding the Bible, that fits to this kind of muscular Christian image. And I've seen since then memes that are amazing to me of even angels with wings but holding, you know, automatic weapons and assault weapons. And I've come across this notion, the journalist Jared Yates Sexton talks about the cult of the shining city, and it's as if there's a whole sort of theology within a theology in which what would normally look like to the naked eye just old-fashioned white nationalism kind of militia style armed groups actually think they are somehow wrapped up with God's divine purpose, that he wants this battle and he wants, you know, great military strength shown to crush dissent and so on. What can you tell us all about that and how Trump fits into that?
Trump fits perfectly into this idea that white Christian nationalism brings with it certain commitments to patriarchy, or the idea of the strong, masculine, muscular Christianity, that men belong at the center and that men are the leaders, and that women, heterosexual men, let's be clear about that, and women then are to follow. And Trump fits perfectly within that. So when Trump rolls out with the defense secretary and his entourage and the police are dispersing tear gas, this moment is read by many on the right as a display of the power of Christianity to push back and to fight evil. Of course, the evil here are the protesters, and for Trump to stand and hold the Bible. And there are many Christians, white Christians in particular, who found that to be objectionable. But you did have a slither of the far right who saw within that something that was to be lionized and to be celebrated.
Yeah. And as you say, there are divisions of opinion even there, and we haven't gone much into the notion of whether back in the 50s and 60s there were Christians who were saying that not just Christianity didn't just approve of patriarchy, but it approved even of white supremacy and gave a kind of religious license to segregation, in particularly in the American South. But let's bring it up to date and what America's evangelical Christians, white ones in particular, do now that their man has been defeated. Is it your sense that some of them will now take stock and pause and think, how did we go down this road of being allied with this man who behaved this way? Or will they double down and stay loyal to him? They do have in the current or in the incoming president, Joe Biden, a man of faith. He's a Catholic. What will they make of that? So where now for America's white evangelicals, do you think, Lorraine Martin?
If history is any indication, we should expect the politics of grievance, a politics that says we have been pushed to the side and now we have this president who claims to be a Catholic, right? They would say, but he's not really a true Christian because of his beliefs around same-sex marriage and abortion and economic policy. We should expect to see that there will be a politics of grievance. And frankly, it's already started, right? We see complaints about the election being stolen. So if that is any indication, we should expect a politics of grievance and a politics of crisis, and for Trump to try to rev everyone up in anticipation of 2024 for Trump to run again. And I think we should expect that. The question that I have for my white evangelical brothers and sisters is, will they line up with him again?
We always ask Lerone a what else question on this podcast about something completely different. This week, what else? Rudy Giuliani has contracted coronavirus. Do you think that's going to change the minds of people who until now have been pretty skeptical about whether this threat is even real and thought somehow it's maybe hyped up and exaggerated? Seeing one of the president's closest associates and advisors getting sick with coronavirus, is it going to move minds, do you think?
Unfortunately, I'm not hopeful that it will. It didn't seem to change much when Donald Trump contracted the virus. All the studies that we're seeing from health experts say that for the most part, people don't change their mind about the coronavirus until someone they personally know is afflicted with the virus, and then minds begin to change. And especially now that there is a vaccine on the horizon, I don't anticipate that Rudy Giuliani's diagnosis will change many hearts of those who argue that the virus is a hoax.
As the death toll in America is nearing around the figure of 3,000 a day, a 9/11 every day, I fear, Lerone Martin, that you're right. Thank you so much for what has been a completely fascinating conversation. Lerone Martin, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that is all from us for this week. Do keep sending us in your questions to podcasts@theguardian.com. Or you can always follow me on Twitter. My name there is @Friedland. And remember, it's a double E. The producer is Danielle Stevens, and I'm Jonathan Friedland. In a week where we saw the very welcome sight of people getting the first doses of the coronavirus vaccine, I really do hope you're all managing to keep safe and well out there. And as always, thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.